Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot, and this is the first episode of Season 2. I'm Max, and today I'm joined in the studio by the ever-present Rory and Daniel. And now we're covering the political landscape and how it has shifted completely, because the man stepping into number 10 isn't a traditional Westminster insider. It's Andy Burnham. The former mayor of Greater Manchester has made his dramatic return to Parliament as the MP for Makerfield, winning the Labour leadership and taking the keys to Downing Street. From running Greater Manchester to running the entire country, Burnham is promising to rewire the state. But what does his government actually look like? How is the opposition reacting? And can he dodge the same traps that caught his predecessor, Keir Starmer? In this episode, we'll examine what a Burnham premiership and future cabinet may look like, the Conservative reshuffle under Kemi Badenoch, and Reform UK's mounting financial controversies and surging donations to its leader, Nigel Farage. And also, to watch out for in the coming weeks as we prepare for John Healey to deliver his first budget. So let's get into it. We start with the transition that caught Westminster off guard. Andy Burnham's ascent to Prime Minister marks a complete break from the Starmer era. Burnham campaigned on being a circuit breaker, promising a radical shift away from centralised control in London. Daniel, hello and welcome back to the podcast.
Thank How you are you having feeling? Me back.
Now, just reflecting on Andy Burnham's first 50 days or so in charge, what are your thoughts on how he's adapted to his new position now as head of the entire country, would you say?
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, it's controversial and might be a bit debatable, but I think that he hasn't really been much adapting. Rather, he's brought his persona and northernness, if I may, into Westminster with his whole goal of trying to quote-unquote, do politics differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we'll all agree that that's a phrase that we've heard a lot throughout the years from our different prime ministers. Do politics differently, make a real change, things like that. And if you hear, he's had a relatively strong start. Looking back to when he was in Westminster earlier with the health secretary thing, but I think you guys have already touched on that slightly, so I won't. But, yeah, I think he's trying to bring over his popularity from being mayor of Manchester, which he did very well, to now trying to, quote unquote, do politics differently. But I remain still sceptical, quietly optimistic, to be honest, because we've been told that time and time again.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I think it's been a decent start. Could have been worse.
Yeah, and Rory, hello, welcome back.
It's
been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So I thought Daniel just said about how Burnham's not really adapting, but he's more bringing his persona into Westminster. Mm. What you said, talking about the idea of taking power away from Westminster and giving it to local councils or mayors who are able to have more authority now than they've ever been able to have before. Yeah. Would you say that Burnham needs to learn about the difference between governing a city like Manchester and the entire country? And is he almost thinking they're the same thing? And is this a mistake that he could potentially make in the future, mixing the two up?
Look, I think seeing his policies and the vision that he set out in the first few weeks of his government, like I'm going to use the £2 bus fare as a sort of example, but I think he's really seeing the role of Prime Minister as an extension to that of his role as the mayor of Greater Manchester, when he was the mayor of Greater Manchester, he was more focused on spending money in that were government grants instead of making money, which is actually something that he's now responsible for as being prime minister.
Yeah,
I think that he is trying to, or he is focused far more on popularity than policy, if I may, or actual kind of values or principles that he probably sticks behind. And you see this through the killers of PC Andrew Harper, and how he's now made his Justice Secretary very, he's been very insistent that the killers stay in prison and not part of the early release scheme. And in that sense, I actually do think that he has been quite adaptive.
Would you say that the decision to not allow PC Andrew Harper's killers to be released is the correct one, would you say?
That is definitely the correct one. But I think by him doing that, he's really trying to gain popularity, support, approval from people who would probably be more... Looking towards parties like Reform UK. I am not looking towards Reform UK for the record, but I'm just saying those sort of things. People who are probably more culturally right-wing would respect that decision, would approve of that decision. I personally think it's the right decision. I think that you two would also... I don't think it's actually really a sort of party political issue or an ideological issue.
No, not really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think...
A killer should not be part of...
Yeah, I don't think there's really a debate when it comes to that, really.
Well, then I think that he is actually trying to put in the hard yards to preserve his popularity, because actually, fundamentally, I think in these days, popularity is... sadly, more valued than
fiscal responsibility. Really,
100%, well, just responsibility in general and competence.
Yeah, of course.
Particularly by
I think
the
Keir Starmer was so unpopular. What he was actually doing abroad, his foreign policy was not actually that bad. I thought he did deal with a few issues quite
well. Well, it's not even about
well,
foreign policy, but because he's not popular, he doesn't actually have. Yeah, just maybe won a mandate. He actually doesn't have like the power or the authority to deliver those policies. And I think actually in this day and age, you need the popularity as well as your own mandate to secure the sort of right and the authority to achieve
like
what
if you're
you've
getting
set
clicks
out.
On your Instagram posts, basically. Sometimes is how you've got young voters and people just who don't really know much about what the prime ministers are actually doing will just see people slating a prime minister and go along with it because that's what they're being told and that's what they're enjoying clicking on.
I think also because of like social media and like the new sort of technology that's associated with it, people have probably become a little bit more sort of, I don't want to say radicalized, but they've felt much more comfortable with what would have been much more controversial opinions just because they're now
people are going to click on
but also because it actually connects them to people or like puts them in forums with other like
yeah it
people.
Puts them in echo chambers
and that gives them
confirmed
kind of validates their opinions, which otherwise
well yeah because if they see the same thing over and over again validated. They're going to think people share their view
or just that their view won't be challenged. That's the main problem.
And I think
it's the rise of populism in social media.
And I think that Burnham, what he's doing is very clever with how he's using TikTok, social media, the videos of him playing the guitar. It's quite clever.
I find it really cringy.
No, but he's getting, I mean, he's getting the optimism back in Britain again. We've heard that many times before. But reform, I mean, Nigel Farage has done so well.
About hope against David Cameron? No.
Tony Blair.
Reform have done so well with their advertising, their marketing to younger people, trying to get them into politics with their controversial views sometimes.
Yeah.
And then I think that Burnham now using social media is good. I think he's portraying himself as a really great figure, like he was as...
really great guy, plays something...
Greater Manchester. No, he seems like a really nice guy, but can he deliver is the question. And he's got these plans, social care reforms, bringing the welfare bill down, but Rory... aren't all parties trying to do that? And how is he really going to do this if he doesn't have the mandate to do that?
Well, I would argue that he does have the mandate to do that because that was sort of Keir Starmer's sort of mandate is to fix the economy. I think.
Well, there is quite a broad branch then to fit those into fixing the economy.
Well, that was the Labour manifesto. I mean, it could have been any party's manifesto. That's how vague and how non-specific it would have been. Obviously, I say it could have been any party's manifesto.
Yeah, of course.
But like, obviously, with a bit more detail, it could have been. So actually, if you think about it, he's actually got a lot of leeway as far as what he wants to do because there actually aren't strict, quote-unquote, rules to go with. Whether he's going to get his own mandate in the general election, that's for another episode. Personally, I think he will go for it, but we'll wait and see.
That is a debate for another idea, but a few good things to say about that.
We can pencil that in for next episode if you want.
Of course, yeah.
But I think that, most parties want to get the welfare bill down, other than the Greens, who live in cloud cuckoo land, and some of the elements of the some of the elements of the Labour Party who actually want to be in cloud cuckoo land with the Greens. I think that.
Well, the problem
with Keir Starmer, which we saw in July of last year, i.e. in 2025, was that he couldn't appease he was weaker than the MPs, or actually a lot of MPs that he helped elect, and he had to back down by producing a bill that he wished to cut money and ending up with a bill that actually cost money, which I think Kevin Baynor pointed out was the first time that ever happened in one of the Prime Minister questions sessions. But look, I think that the welfare bill is certainly too high. I think it needs to be cut. I think a lot of these politicians, like Labour politicians, Keir Starmer, Andy Burnham, John Healey, Rachel Reeve, they talk a good game on tackling benefits, but actually, where are the results?
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if
it doesn't happen. I wouldn't be surprised if
Healey raised taxes instead of cut spending, because actually, if we cut spending, then we're actually promoting more sustainable economic
practices.
Pause there. Okay.
Daniel, so Royce mentioned John Healy's potentially going to raise taxes.
He is going to raise taxes.
Well, what do you say to the fact that he may raise taxes? I mean, are you on board with the idea of potentially raising taxes, or would you prefer to cut the spending and government debt and focus more on redistribution in certain departments, sort of find the money to make cuts? Daniel?
I think there are a few things that I'd cut, looking into things I consume myself. More generally speaking, right now, people need money in their pockets. And so instead of taxing them, I'd say look to taxing other more richer individuals.
Well, if you tax them, they're going to leave.
People like Gary Lineker...
He can donate.
If
he's so patriotic and he wants to do it, then he can donate. That's fine. Yeah. No one's stopping him.
Yeah.
Send a check. What's
your opinion on a wealth tax, Rory?
I think a one-time wealth tax isn't actually the worst idea in the world compared to a rising income tax.
But we can't lose people.
A vast majority.
If it's a one-time wealth tax, then you're not going to lose people or you're not going to lose as much people, because it's not a regular thing that you constantly got to avoid. It's a one-time thing.
It's a one-off, yeah.
And then once you're in the clear, then it's fine. Then there's no reason for you to leave, because it's not like they're going to tax you again. Obviously, if it's Labour, then they might tax you again, because you know how they are with their promises.
That's true.
I think the principle is it is much better than a rise in income tax. I would agree with that. I would prefer a cut in spending than a one-time tax.
As a billionaire, we can't have them just leaving the country, because of course their companies or businesses provide a lot of valuable income to our government,
and
that can be distributed, can't it?
That we have right now, I'm encountering a lot of hostility towards rich individuals because of things like people having a lot harder time with the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, and I see
what you mean. Hostility towards them.
Richer people.
And look, to be honest, I'm not really defending them because they don't need to be defended. But I think that people need to understand that, like, as much I am up for keeping the money in the pockets of working people, I think that and taxing wealthy individuals. I think that a one-time wealth tax of like 50,000 out of two million, the vast majority of those wealthy taxpayers will be up for paying that tax.
What do you mean by up? As in
able? As in they want to.
That's the thing. I think it was
you
like 75% of those, when they were asked, would they pay £50,000 out of their 2 million? People that own over £2 million.
Said that, per year or just in general?
In their assets. In their... Good question, I don't know. Is it an income of 2 million? Wealth tax, is it an income tax or is it an assets tax?
It's just an assets tax. That's what wealth is.
Then it might be 2 million.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, so Daniel's talking about how people are struggling right now. They're obviously at the end of Keir Starmer's reign as his tenure, there wasn't a lot of optimism, there wasn't a lot of hope, really, especially, and people were just almost as Daniel said, the hostility towards the rich sort of grew only because they had more money than them. I don't think, okay, if some people want to pay a one-off tax, okay, go on then, be my guest, Gary Lineker, go on, step out and do it.
You do it, yeah.
But I must say,
he's not really a representative.
Yeah, but he's not representative of all the other people who are wealthy in terms of their assets. I do think that there is, if people are complaining, because we have over 1 in 8 people are out of educational work, yeah? So NEETs. Can we agree on that?
So, do you think cutting taxes 20% on businesses?
I think cutting taxes on national insurance will increase employment, which means that obviously more people are going to be employed, businesses make more money, and then that means the government has more to redistribute into our key services. Rory, do you not think? So, I mean, in our NHS now, I mean, we obviously he's moved Yvette Cooper there, and we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is room in this budget, and I think Labour are going to have to go against that stereotypical DNA of always having to raise taxes, because raising taxes does not promote growth.
Yeah.
And growth is the one thing that the Labour government are trying to promote. And today, in this day and age, raising taxes is not what we should be doing, especially with this crisis.
Yeah, taxes are at the highest level since the Second World War, or at least they were at the general election, and they're up even more. So there is no doubt that the tax system in this country is fundamentally broken. I don't think that by Burnham giving out small little nuggets of good policy, good, beneficial policy, which are the cut on energy rates.
Which only saves about £40 a year anyway, but we'll get... We'll
which isn't the largest sum, but that. Actually it is actually quite a lot of help. I mean,
a little
especially
bit,
when there's an Iranian war.
Well,
that the £2 bus fare, as you were saying earlier, that's not costed. And what's are you costing
it? It was the business cuts on pubs, hotels.
That is good. I approve that, totally, because that's unleashing growth. Business, and that's reinvigorating the pub sector to an extent. But I think that...
There's no guarantee that getting lowering taxes for businesses will make them try and get more employees. There's no businesses crying out for help saying, oh, we're so understaffed in my pub right now, but I can't pay for any more people.
There are lots of people
who want work. I mean,
There's an unemployment crisis in young people. Many pubs are going out of business. You misunderstood what I'm saying. Okay, right, what are you saying?
I'm saying that you cannot guarantee the amount of NEETs or whatever we're going to say, amount of young people especially, as John Hee said, that have just come out of graduation, just come out of education and can't find a job.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee that they will, just because you've lowered tax of businesses, they will be able to walk into a job.
They have said, of course not, because they have to show their credentials, they have an interview.
I don't think it's the point that you're posing. I think what you're trying to say is that there's no guarantee that they'd necessarily pick that job, nor would there be jobs to actually fill.
No, I'm saying the businesses could invest in their automation.
To hire people.
They could just give it to
shareholders. I don't necessarily think that.
Repay debt.
I don't think a lot of pubs are going to go to China and buy robots to pour your beer for you.
Come on.
Well, if you're talking about buying another
self checkout, right? That's what we're talking about right now.
I've never seen a self checkout at the pub. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. We're talking about pubs now, which he's already lowered taxes on.
Yes, that's what we've been talking about for the last two minutes. I disagree with the point that you're trying to put. I think that if you've lowered, there are lots of young people who are out of work, some who choose to be out of work, which I completely condemn, and some who actually just cannot find a job because there are no jobs. If taxes are lowered, that means that it isn't such a strain on businesses to promote more jobs, and they wouldn't have to pay more money to the government for hiring certain people, i.e. there are more job vacancies and more people can fill those jobs. Then you have pub profits growing because you've got more manpower and you can serve more people. And at the same time, the unemployment rate is decreasing because more people have got a job. So it is literally a win-win situation for everyone, which is why I think that's a good policy. But the broader point I was trying to make is that I think it is really irresponsible that Andy Burnham is dishing out these little nuggets of good policy when he needs to in order to keep inflating his popularity. My prediction at the next budget is that perhaps he might not make, well, he's not going to make spending cuts. He might make tax rises, but I don't think that we are going to see major spending. We're not going to see major spending increases because I think the way that Andy Burnham does politics is he's going to keep a big headroom to allow to dish out little policies when he needs to keep inflating
his popularity. Little nuggets to keep his popularity, yes.
Yes, yeah, and he needs to keep those fully costed, otherwise the
economists are going to be out. Well, no, because obviously we're going to have increased government borrowing. We have no money left. And then he's going to have to raise taxes the next budget. Then we all know the cycle that happens from there.
Exactly. It's a doom spiral. It's a Labour spiral.
Now, with Burnham inside number 10, attention immediately turns to his new top team. Now, I think that cabinets reveal strategy, and Burnham has had to balance his desire for rewiring the state and getting popularity with market stability. And this comes with the idea of keeping key figures or shifting the guard has been a massive balancing act. There's a strong focus on a new generation of hope for the future. Younger MPs who are more reform-minded, excuse the pun, who want to break away from old departmental and ideas and push hard on regional growth and housing development. Now, Rory, what are you thinking here at Burnham's cabinet? Because when I first saw that John Healey had been appointed Chancellor, I was surprised, to say the least. And I know he's a safe pair of hands, but I was thinking that Shabana Mahmood might have had a chance, especially since the markets reacted so well to the fact of her perhaps being handed the keys to number 11, but also with the idea that there could also be a revolt on the left side of the party because perhaps she's more right-leaning with her policies, would you say?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, I think it's pretty... just going for your claim that this reshuffle or this new Burnham cabinet is unleashing younger MPs, I think this is very much a legacy cabinet. We've got people like Yvette Cooper. Angela Rayner. We've got people like Ed Miliband, who served as the leader of the Labour Party from 2010 to 2015.
Let me rephrase.
Okay.
I mean, I'm talking about, let's not think younger physically. We'll say mentally in terms of their view for the UK. As in, they've almost like given a clean
more
slate.
More modern MPs.
Yeah, so they've been given a clean slate.
Okay,
That's what I mean.
That was misunderstanding on my
part. No, don't worry, go on.
I think that, just going on your Shabana Mahmood claim, I think it's very important to note that Shabana Mahmood is part of the Blue Labour faction, i.e. she is, like, economically, she is quite your standard Labour, like, politician. Obviously, she's probably slightly more moderate than the vast majority. But Blue Labour is blue, i.e. conservative, because they are more socially conservative, which is why we've seen Shabana Mahmood be far more controlling as far as immigration is concerned. So I actually don't think that she would have been the... she would not have been like a... I know you weren't like proposing that she'd be someone like Kwasi Kwarteng or Liz Truss, but she isn't actually the most conservative chancellor out there. just wanted to clear that up first and foremost. But I think, like, looking at the cabinet generally, I think it is an upgrade, to put it frankly, compared to Keir Starmer's cabinet. I think Keir Starmer's cabinet was quite bleak, quite bland, quite useless.
Actually, I disagree with you on that.
Well, you're not flying bland.
I think Ed Miliband is arguably one of the worst politicians I've ever set eyes on. Genuinely, this guy is incompetent. He's Wallace and Gromit. That's what they were saying.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'll be honest. I mean, Danny, you might have a different view to me here, but I would say, why have we appointed this guy as foreign secretary? He literally insulted Trump on the news, and now we put him as our main...
I groaned when I found out that he was the foreign secretary.
It's a disgrace.
I went back in my chair.
It's loyalty. It's all about loyalty.
I think that for the country, it's a very poor choice. I think for Burnham, it's a very good choice.
Well, yeah, because he believes in him. He's not trusting him.
No, but I think out of all the places that Ed Miliband could have gone, he could have gone to the Treasury.
Yeah, thank God
he didn't go to the Treasury. That would have been a giant disaster. That would have been a giant disaster. The foreign secretary is still a great office of state, but
it's an important office now.
It's not actually majorly affecting government policy. I mean, the Prime Minister might as well be the Foreign Secretary.
Well, the number of trips Keir Starmer made, He was pretty much acting as the foreign secretary. Well, yes, that's a side point
you could extrapolate out of that. But I think that Ed Miliband having a big job, but not necessarily dictating major government policy that he could have been, God forbid, if he was the Chancellor, is actually quite a good move as far as kind of balancing out the factions within the Labour Party. You've given him a good job, but you haven't given him the Treasury, as in,
I see what you mean. I think
he's got a good job.
You made a good point.
The point is, I don't think the job is as like powerful or as major as people used to think it was, nor actually is.
It was not like when David Cameron was Foreign Secretary or Boris Johnson.
I can't remember the last time that the Foreign Secretary was actually dictating government policy on foreign affairs. They were merely delivering on it. They were just the kind of...
They just went over, had a chat, they dash around
to different countries, meet with other foreign representatives, shake a few hands, sign a few treaties, boom, Bob's your uncle, that's done, that's all your job.
Yeah.
Nothing more to it. So I think Ed Miliband going there is actually quite a great relief to everyone else. But as far as the country's concerned, I totally agree with your assessment that he's not a great politician.
Yeah.
I mean, look, someone whose priority is solar panels and wind turbines isn't necessarily going to get on with drill, baby drill, yeah, Donald that, Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, they've had their own spats.
Good point.
It's just not going to work. I mean, he might as well still be the energy secretary.
Donald Trump does hate wind turbines, to be fair. He said it does create a graveyard for pigeons.
Let's not talk about what he hates and what he doesn't.
We'd have to have a few episodes on what Donald Trump
likes. So I approve of Shabana saying there. Now, actually, I think the most important thing that we've got, slightly touched on it when we talk about Ed Miliband, but the Chancellor of the Exchequer... That was quite a shock when I saw that.
No, I mean, when you sort of saw John Healey being the first person to walk in, I mean, you could sort of have a guess at what job.
Yeah, but like even the commentary, they're like...
Walks in first.
Yeah, but I mean, with the kind of context of Andy Burnham wants to do politics differently, who wants to create a number 10 in the North, which is just...
We'll talk about that in a minute.
We'll talk about number 10 North in a minute. It's its own little idea. I don't think it's going to work, but, you know, we'll see. I think that... Him going up first may not have necessarily meant he was getting Chancellor. Maybe you're just going to shake up the traditions. Yeah. After all, that's what Andy Burnham is all about, isn't it?
Well, he got rid of the lectern, didn't he? He went informal.
He got rid of the lectern. He went David Cameron style.
What did you think of that? Did you like that? I mean, you're like a traditionalist. I mean, I was just...
Yeah, but I, like, I mean, if you want to set yourself out from the others, I don't necessarily think that your preference on whether you speak with a lectern or not is... necessarily, but he's sort of signalling
he wants to do politics differently. He wants to go in with a bang. I think it's not an offensive, it's a nice little touch in my opinion, if you want my raw opinion.
I think it's actually slightly pathetic that he wants to express himself.
And why do you think
based
that?
On his well, it's not a big deal, it's just a lectern. Why don't you want the lectern?
Well,
maybe he thinks it acts as a barrier. Maybe he wants to have, you know, face-to-face conversation with the country.
It's not COVID. It's not like there's a big glass screen.
No, you don't understand. You don't understand the people that have been let down completely by politics in the last 20 years.
Well, okay, well, I wonder how many of them...
If he just wants to not have a lectern and try and be a bit different, and he's not causing any offence apart from you...
Well, he's not causing offence. No offence taken, obviously. I think it's fine, if I was him, I would have found a different way to express my let's do politics differently.
Okay,
all you've done.
Okay.
Pink suit.
No, I'll pause you guys there. We're getting off topic. Okay, so anyway, so aside from the lectern... back to John Healey.
Is it definitely the biggest, like, move in the cabinet, I think?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I do
that
think...
That was like a top 10 political twists.
Yeah, I do think that...
Did you enjoy that, Rory?
Well, it wasn't Ed Miliband, so yeah, I was actually.
No, okay, so anyway, as I was saying, so obviously we know about John Healey resigning as Defence Secretary. I'm guessing obviously Rory knows this, Daniel as well, about obviously there's not enough defence spending and how we need to reach the correct amount. And I think that...
So two-faced.
That has to be, if we're appointing a Chancellor who's heavy on defence spending... I'd like to see some more money in defence, please.
Well, yes.
His answer to, like, everyone's saying we're not putting money in defence, so we're gonna put the Chancellor of the Exchequer,
and we're gonna make them from the Foreign Secretary to the Chancellor of Exchequer. And that's his argument for saying we're putting more money in defence. It's quite weak, to be honest. Like,
well,
just,
no,
just
I think,
saying
I think,
that
okay, necessarily
we're like, doing a lot about it just that, by okay, making him chancellor.
I think it's not the fact that he was defence secretary. It's the fact that he resigned as defence secretary
because
for that
of that
particular
reason.
Reason.
He was yeah, so passionate yeah, about that. That's the reason he just resigned. So I well, expect that to be his first, the first thing he does in the budget.
That's the first.
Give me some defence spending.
That was
spending.
The first thing I thought that would be the first thing he'd announce, not some bus fares. Like, he wasn't
no,
the transport
secretary.
No,
but I think that, I didn't think they could have gone as big as that. I think they had to build it
okay,
up a
fine,
little bit.
Okay, fine. Okay, maybe I'm getting a little bit critical with the nitty-gritty, but I think it would be disappointing. I think it would be quite, not a betrayal, because he's not necessarily, we've not put his trust, our trust in him, but I think it would be quite interesting if he doesn't actually raise or commits to raise defence spending with
well,
a timetable. Considering that he resigned over
well,
it,
we know what he wants, isn't it? We know that he
we know
wants
what he
to,
wants, but
yeah,
if I was
how short's the leash, basically.
Well, if I was Chancellor, I'd do what the hell I wanted.
Well, I mean, well, of course you would. You have the
also,
power.
It works quite well with the narrative that Andy Burnham wants to kind of please everyone. What about the people who, if a nuclear war breaks out, not suggesting it will, how about the people that will die in that fallout? What about them?
Well,
don't
I
hear
don't
anything
understand
about them.
The point you're trying to make.
Well, what is the point you're trying? I'm a bit confused yeah, of what you're trying to get at.
We need to protect this country.
Of course we do. What have you just said about defence spending?
Yes, exactly. So if he's not raising
defence spending, but would you? Okay, but is the money's not
that
there?
That is a priority, not benefit scroungers.
Yeah, but the money's not there.
Then cut spending and create the money.
Yeah, but they're not going to. They can't.
That's the problem.
I know.
That's the problem.
His whole like thing about saying, yeah, look, I want to spend loads of money on defence. Look at me. I've put the guy who resigned as defence minister as chancellor. But then he's going to keep him on a really short leash and say, no, we're going to do the bus thing. And like he's going to have to go.
I wouldn't be surprised if John Healey resigned over
that
again.
He's probably
going
to do that because he's not going
to
get to do what he wants, which is put loads of money in big
bombs.
Well,
I think he's going to absolutely like fluff it as Chancellor.
He's
going to do a bad job because he's going to go into the same traps as Rachel Reeves, and then he's going to resign over principle again to save his reputation.
Yeah, yeah.
If he doesn't do it in the budget, I've lost a lot of confidence and I've lost a lot of respect for a man that I did actually have a lot of confidence.
I thought he was competent, to be fair.
When he came into the Treasury, and a lot of respect for when he resigned over principle.
Well, he's worked in the Treasury before. I mean, he has.
I'd just like to go back on my side about him not having a good time in office. I reckon he'll be okay.
You think
John Healey will have a good time?
He won't have a good time, and he might have to resign again over principle. But,
so, hang on a minute.
But I don't think
how's
he'll
he going
do anything
to...
wrong.
Okay.
Which is the standards that I'm holding right now.
Yeah, okay. So, guys, would you, just to wrap up, maybe we'll have a bit more, maybe 5 more minutes on this little bit here, but would you say that you would rather see perhaps nothing change at the next budget instead of these massive tax rises, would you say? I mean, you'd rather see Burnham be more pragmatic than radical.
Well, I don't think that the position he was left in is necessarily pragmatic.
Keir Starmer's very pragmatic.
So wait, sorry, is the option do nothing?
The option is do nothing or raise taxes.
I mean, how much more do you want? I think it'll be
that's
pragmatic.
Like, what do you want? Do you want to die by gunshot?
Well, okay.
Or do you want to die by being stabbed?
I'd rather be shot.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay.
I'm sorry that you've already thought about that.
Okay. So what's it going to be? What would you say? As in, let's just say you didn't have any affiliation
okay,
with any
well,
party.
Look,
you just rocked up on the day. So would you rather stick with what we're going with the country now?
Okay, look, in my opinion, my thought process is, are we going to pick a financial system with these certain constraints that works extremely poorly, or are we going to pick something that is going to work even worse? And so I'm going to have to go with the first option
because
as much as things seem they can't get worse, they sure can.
Yeah, but
I think also with his sort of like populism a bit that he's using with things like social media and trying to show his personality more, which you have to argue is working. I think that him saying he wants to do politics differently and saying like, oh, look, I play football, I play the guitar, is enough. I don't think it is enough in truth, but I think on the surface, which isn't where many voters are actually looking, on the surface, I think that That is enough for him to look like he's doing politics differently, when really I think we'll see quite a pragmatic plan.
But I was reading an article the other day saying, okay, Burnham's summer tour is finished. Now he actually has to face some questions. And I mean, Kenny Badenoch was saying at the first Prime Minister's question,
she's ruthless.
He said, oh, I'm so happy she's that he's excellent. Finally decided to come and answer some questions from me. He's been hiding. He has been hiding. Yeah. At least he had one interview with Laura Koonsberg over the entire summer. Yeah. And it was just him in Number 10 North, basically where he lives now.
Oh, God, please don't stop
hanging
number
out.
10 North.
Just say Number 10 North.
Number 10 North is probably this decade's worst
solution.
You know, actually, I visited Number... I went outside.
Yeah, you were at Manchester.
I did go to Number 10
You went to
North.
Number 10 North.
I thought, what's happened there then? Why are we taking power away from Westminster? What's this whole devolution that he's trying to do? Why are we bringing everything to Manchester? Manchester's not the north. We have the north.
Yeah, yeah.
The north is like Glasgow. The north is Scotland.
Yeah, I
please.
Think I've said Manchester, the north.
That's not the north.
I send my heart out to all the Scottish people who are completely getting forgotten about. It's like you've got the south of England, then you've got the Midlands where no one really knows where it starts or ends. Then you've got the north, and then you just got Scotland, which might as well be the south because
yeah, you can't just like move away. You can't be away from tradition like that. You can't set up your whole operations base in
that's like me
in the a
argument
completely
was the argument
place.
Trying not to be too London centrist. Is that what he's trying to do with the whole Number 10 North thing?
He's trying to give power back to the people, is his main sort of idea.
He wants to take power away from Westminster.
If you think that, then you're an anarchist. I think devolution in certain respects is good because that improves efficiency. You don't have to go all the way up the chain to get an answer that could have come up from like two or three levels above. I think that is totally sound. But I don't necessarily think that we should be constantly bullying London just because all the financial capital is there. Like, if businesses want to move to Manchester, they can, but we're not, like, forcing them or taxing them or taking money from London taxpayers and investing it in the north of England.
Well, he's sort of focusing on the north-south divide. He's sort of trying to
change
that,
isn't he? Well, there is a north-south divide. I recognise it. Burnham is completely going on the offensive on it.
So what Kemi said about he's living in 1970s.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah.
Well, no, he's talking about, oh, I mean, have you guys seen the... I mean, he's got us like 3 points.
I watched
it. We took a wrong turn with Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s was this thing. What
yeah.
was it?
Do
the
politics.
It was the privatisation of what essentially
the privatisation, yeah. the deindustrialisation.
I think the deindustrialisation, he is right. With that, the fact that we did deindustrialize lots of people's jobs. That's I agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with that thesis.
That's a good
but
point.
I think
it doesn't cost anything just to build a Number 10 North.
The point I'm trying to make is that if we did not have London, we would be a third world country.
Yeah, well, that was your point.
Major businesses want
obvious.
To move there. That's where. Oh, that's where the Houses of Parliament are. That's where Downing Street is.
That's where the monarchs are.
It's like
that's where all the other goddamn businesses are. If everyone moves, then everyone moves, and that's totally fine. But you can't keep separating people. Otherwise, you're just completely clogging up the system.
Now, who originally separated the people, Rory? Who originally separated the people?
Pardon?
Who originally made social inequality between different parts of the UK?
That was, like, feudalism. We just didn't...
Feudalism has been around, and we're going back to the south. We had the Norwegians coming in from the right, but I think
like places like Cornwall, which are in the south, they're actually not that rich compared to I'd arguably say parts of the north. I think it's just kind of how far they are away from London kind of dictates how rich they are, because London is the focal point, the epicentre of the British economy. If we don't have London,
I liked how you said epicentre.
Nothing works. That's why.
Yeah, well, you're stating the obvious.
That's why the home. Sorry?
You're stating the obvious. Well, if we've made a mountain out of a molehill, we're talking about Number 10 North, aren't we? So having,
yes, but I think,
having
no,
a Number 10
we,
North
we,
in Manchester is doing no harm to anyone, and it kind of feels like.
He thinks it's too radical. He's trying to get rid of Downing Street, number 10, south. I think the concept is stupid. I think what he's trying to... That is not the solution to the problems of the country. Having...
No, the idea of devolution...
Neither is having a lectern or not having a lectern.
The idea of devolution is a good one.
Okay, I'm not... I don't think that Number 10 North is going to, like, reduce, like... is going to cause recession in the North
Midlands. No one was arguing that.
Yeah, he thinks that it's going to cause a lot of growth.
Did he tell you that? Like, did he say that in an interview anywhere?
It doesn't take a fool to realise that, though.
No, he's not. He's just trying
He's giving more power. He's giving more power to the North of England. He's giving more funding to the North of England. And you can see that the symbolism of putting number 10 North, putting some executive function
in the North of England, that's his base.
Is actually now him symbolising that London, you're out, Manchester and Liverpool,
Manchester's in.
He's
not saying London, you're out.
No, he is.
That's the implication.
That's his idea.
That's the implication.
It's not that harsh, though. It's...
It's more subtle
I don't
than that. Yeah, I agree,
you're not
I agree
saying
with that.
He's saying London out. I don't care about London. Let's take London away.
Okay,
make
that's
a
obviously
a
hyperbole. He's not. And it's not very helpful for this argument, to be honest.
Okay, sorry. To all the listeners, I'm sorry.
No, sorry. I'm sorry. But I think it's far more of a gesture, to be honest.
Yeah.
And you're shaking your head off camera.
So, after that argument, it's not just Labour going through major changes. Over on the opposition benches, the Conservative leader, Kevin Badenoch, has launched a ruthless, high-stakes reshuffle. And Badenoch didn't waste any time. Sacking Samuel Strye, the Shadow Chancellor, and bringing in Andrew Griffith is a clear signal. They are gearing up for the possibility that Burnham might snap the trigger of an early election and try and create his mandate. Now, Rory, you're probably more familiar with Andrew Griffith than I am. And all I know so far is that obviously he used to work in the Treasury and he was working on Liz Truss's mini budget.
Yeah.
And for someone who perhaps is not as invested in the Conservative Party as maybe you are, I would say that perhaps on the surface would look like a silly decision in the fact that the Conservatives were just about to regain this credibility that they were looking to get back. Obviously, they were doing quite well in the polls. And now, I mean, I liked Samuel Strye. I thought he didn't exactly do anything wrong. But she's bringing in someone who supported the budget that completely crashed the economy. Where's the credibility there?
Look, I think people are focusing too much on the fact that he was there when it happened. It was the wrong place at the wrong time. He was a junior minister. It's not like he made all the plans. That was Kwasi Kwarteng and more... Importantly, that was Liz Truss's economic agenda. You can't be blaming farmers nearby a volcanic eruption just because they used too much fertile soil. Like that's just such a stupid argument. I can understand it to an extent, putting my kind of stupid woke hat on. But I think people are... The point that Kemi's trying to make is that he's got 26 years of private business experience, the private sector experience. The whole cabinet to get put together... 21 years. He's got 5 more years of private sector experience than the entire cabinet. He is going to bring growth to this country. He's going to cut the red tape. He's going to cut taxes, cut spending. He's going to provide.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if he was at the
economic revolution.
It doesn't matter if he was at the wrong place at the wrong time. He was still there.
Yeah, he was still there. I was still at home when the mini budget.
Are we arguing what he did and what happened while he was there? Are we arguing the equality of himself as a politician?
I don't think he made the hugest of him. Put it this way. If Andrew... I'll put you to this question.
I'm listening.
If Andrew Griffiths was not in the Treasury at the time of the mini budget, do you think the mini budget would have been a success?
Well, no.
Exactly. Well, so it's not like he necessarily changed the whole outcome of the situation.
No, I'm on Rory's side here. I think either we're arguing the quality of him as a politician or arguing what happened at the time and if he was responsible for it. Is he responsible for it? No.
Yeah, of course he's not responsible because he's a junior minister, but other...
That's why it's a fundamentally stupid idea.
But the other parties are going to go after him, do you not think?
Of course they are. Of course they are. That's his biggest weakness.
And, I mean...
Everyone's got baggage.
But why...
Everyone's got baggage.
But why are we replacing Samuel Strye? He didn't do anything wrong.
He didn't... Okay.
Yeah, he didn't do anything wrong, but he didn't do anything. So
exactly, that's the problem. The Conservative Party is not in a stage where do nothing is okay. They've actually got to be far more proactive with growth policies and just wider economic policies. Mel Stride, I respect him, rest in peace in his cabinet position, but he didn't necessarily skyrocket the Conservatives' approval on the economy. I think that...
Yeah, but he did his job.
He did his job, but he needs to do more than his job. He needs to go above and beyond. And unfortunately, he didn't do that. That's why he's the person that I was probably the most critical of as, after Richard Holden, I can't stand the fact he's still there. I've had a growing resentment for him since he's been reappointed Shadow Transport Secretary. We're not going to get into that because that's too junior, too irrelevant to talk about. But listeners of this podcast would know that Mel Stride was not the only Shadow Cabinet casualty.
Yes.
She
pops.
Ding dong, the Wicked Witch is dead.
Don't say that.
Oh, that is funny.
That's really hurtful. No. Cannot be inciting violence.
People are listening.
No.
Rory's
okay.
Crying right now.
I mean,
I'm not crying. I'm putting a brave
My opinion,
face.
I wasn't a fan of Pretty Patel. I think Tom Tugendhat is...
Tom Tugendhat is a better choice.
Former army, veteran, very respectable
he's a better
person.
Choice.
Good relationship.
Pretty was bad. She was bad.
To be fair, Boris
Johnson's cabinet or Pretty in... The Shadow Cabinet.
Oh, well.
But I don't think Pretty in the Shadow...
In Boris Johnson's cabinet, she was probably an utter disaster. But, I like the woman. She's got good vibes. That's why I like her.
There you go. Was she actually good?
But I think...
We're clearly biased then.
I think she could have been a pretty good chairman. I don't know why we've kept Kevin Hollenrake. I think that was a bad idea.
Yeah, and...
He's just a bit of a crybaby. I don't want to say it, but, he just starts ranting on about irrelevant things.
Everyone has baggage, Rory. Yeah.
Everyone has baggage. Yeah, I've color coded some of the appointments based on how good
Rory, just to wheel you in.
Okay, yeah, fine. Sorry,
I messaged you. I don't know if you remember after. Mel was obviously sacked. I thought Claire Coutinho was in with a shot. I thought she is proving herself to be a bit of a force. Within the party, maybe future chairman, perhaps.
Okay, here's my prediction. I think that if Andrew Griffiths gets attacked on the fact that he was there at the wrong place at the wrong time...
It's a weak argument, I realise that.
And he gets shuffled out, I think Claire is the best placed person to replace him. I think the moment that Mel Stride was sacked was the moment I knew that Claire Coutinho was not going to get the Shadow Chancellor role, because... I would have thought that, background, a bit of context, Claire Coutinho is pregnant, she's going on maternity leave, that's why she's not actually actively in the Shadow Cabinet. She's been put as Shadow Business Secretary, but actually the former Shadow Science Secretary, Julia Lopez, who's had her department scrapped, is covering her temporarily. So she isn't necessarily going to go straight into the one of the great big offices of state if she's in, she's having a child, that's not going to happen. She was going to leave the Shadow Cabinet. So when Mel left, there's a vacancy.
She
can't necessarily fill it. So that's open to someone else.
Did you think
Andrew Griffiths.
That, did
so
you
I think,
think
I yeah, thought, yeah, okay. I thought, that, I've got my prediction up here. I thought Mel would temporarily keep his role or he'd stay.
And wait until.
And then when Claire came back,
over,
off you pop.
But did you think that Andrew Griffiths would be the replacement for Mel Stride? Did you see that as the next best person, really? I mean, you spoke about his experience. He's been working in banking before.
Yeah, he worked at Sky.
So he has got a bit of credibility in
he's
the past.
He's got a lot of credibility. I was quite laser focused on Claire being Shadow Chancellor, so I didn't really accommodate other options. But I wasn't surprised when Andrew came in, because he's a very keen supporter of Kemi, and he obviously was the former Shadow Business Secretary, which is pretty much number two, other than maybe arguably Chief Secretary to the Treasury. That's a growing department. Business, trade, I think they've thrown in science and innovation, and they broke up science.
Just to jump on another departure.
Yeah.
In this party, obviously, Sir James cleverly has a... Obviously, he's running for London Mayor.
Oh, wow.
And
you
I think.
No, I didn't know.
Have you guys seen the picture of Sadiq Khan, John Healy, and Keir Starmer all in Sainsbury's together, helping all the packing, and they're in their purple outfits with the name tags on?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite funny. I do think that he has a shot.
Sadiq Khan is...
Here we go. Let's, oh, here, okay, we, here we go. Come
I'm
going
to sit back.
Right, go on, give us it.
Go on now, stay quiet.
Okay. Give it the big one.
Sadiq Khan isn't the greatest mayor out there.
He oh, well, I was quiet.
Utter, he is...
Okay.
This is the quiet part of the storm. He is utterly incompetent. His whole philosophy of controlling London is constraining it, damaging it, trashing it. He's got his deputy mayor. Obviously, I mean, I follow this quite because... He's so stupid, and I like feeling validated about how correct I am.
Bit of introspection.
So I look at other like stupid people. So just follow the Labour Instagram if you want that. but yeah. Look, his deputy mayor for policing. I can't remember what her name is. She can't answer a single question.
Yeah,
can't answer it.
I have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, dodging. Susan Hall, you can't just stop dodging. Answer the question.
Bicycles.
Mate.
They're stupid. I mean, if you're going to...
Yeah, all politicians are really trained at
He's digging up roads in London. He's getting rid of roundabouts to create those, like, X crossings just so we can get AI cars to drive around. Like, that's a little bit premature, isn't it? Like, we've got problems with our water supply because of AI. I don't think necessarily we're going to trust AI with driving us around.
So he's doing the little nuggets, isn't he? But they're not...
That's
exactly...
not little nuggets.
No.
It costs £1 million to do, like, a 100-metre road to do it up. No. If I was the mayor of London,
what would you do, Rory?
I'd cut all the spending that we're currently spending on road, like, obviously, road maintenance, totally fine. I agree with
but
that.
We need
we
money.
Need to do
money.
That.
Yeah.
But if we're rearranging tarmac so it looks like an X instead of an O, then we should be investing that money into...
We
should be investing
in the tube, the public services. Yes.
So
the tube. Okay. Why the tube? The tube in particular doesn't need any roads. I mean, the roads, so many potholes, so many bad drivers, so many cyclists with their headphones in, they're all going to die. Like, it's not the fault of the
people on e-bikes, stealing phones.
It's not the fault of the... Yeah, exactly.
Balaclava ban Nottingham, everyone.
It's not the fault of the driver. It's not the fault of the driver for driving 10 miles per hour more than someone who's got noise cancellation on their AirPods Max. Like, what are we doing here?
Can I jump in?
If you travel on the Victoria line, it is the definition of hell. It is hot, it is dark, it is musty. You can hear the screams of your ancestors down there. We've got to improve the rails. We've got to put aircon in there.
Yeah,
especially during the summer. People are melting like an ice cream in Bournemouth. Like, what are we doing?
Why Bournemouth?
Why Bournemouth. But anyway, thank you, guys, for that analysis.
Rory, you can take your stupid woke hat off.
So that's it. From Andy Burnham's arrival in Westminster to a revamped Tory front bench, British politics has entered a completely volatile new era. The faces at the top have changed, but the massive economic and public service challenges waiting inside Downing Street remain exactly the same. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Ballot this week, and join us next week as we continue to unpack the forces shaping politics both at home and abroad. Thank you, and goodbye.